There is this thing. Do you realize?
Our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize?
Our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news are brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's community news program, Off the Hour. Today is March 12th. My name is Alice Wu, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Gunungahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. On the show today, we're going to be talking about the one-year mark of the pandemic and the appeal of a Quebec Superior Court decision to change the provincial code. Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
C is for
cauliflower,
confusion, creation,
pickle, K is for
kitten,
cam,
seat, wait, fiandro, seat, U, unbearable,
U is for underground,
oh yeah,
umbrella,
T, trite,
tremendous,
torment,
tire,
C, K,
I can't think of a U one,
T,
F is for famous,
fun, fumble, M is for Montreal.
First news. The Quebec government announced COVID-19 vaccinations are now available to those 65 and up on the island of Montreal. The city is the first region in Quebec to offer vaccines to individuals under 70. The province is also looking for volunteers to help run vaccination sites. And related to the pandemic, all three known variants of the COVID-19 virus are now in Montreal. And a revised neighborhood plan for park extension was released this week. The Table de Quartier pour Parc Extension organization held community meetings in the last 2 years to hear what residents want for the future of their borough. They'll be hosting their latest on March 26th, distilling recommendations to revive the plan. It's the first held in 2021. And bookstore owner Stephen Welch won a negotiation with landlord Schiller Levy. Levy allegedly raised the rent of the space by 150% and ignited a controversy centered on gentrification of the Mile End. Welch announced that the store will be staying for another 2 years. Anti-gentrification group Mile End Ensemble was created in response to this rent increase, and they'll be hosting a read-in at the store tomorrow. And lastly, March 8th marked International Women's Day. Community groups held events in the last few days like a rally at Cabot Square organized by the Raging Grannies and a celebratory webinar by Afrique au Féminin. Women's History Month will continue throughout March. The province also marked the first anniversary of the pandemic.
Hi, I'm Sarah Jesmer, and I'm part of the News Collective on this show. The Quebec government marked the first anniversary of the COVID-19 pandemic on March 11th, yesterday, in honor of those who lost their lives. At least 10,503 people have died in the province, according to official counts. Quebecers account for nearly half of Canada's total COVID-19 death rate, and is the province with the highest loss of life. Most of these were older people in the first wave of 2020 in institutional care. The memorial was held Thursday outside the National Assembly. People stood 6 feet apart as they faced a small wreath made out of white roses and a large screen projecting an orchestra playing on a remote stage. A blue banner was laid across the wreath that said, "Je me souviens." Those in attendance laid down their single flowers one by one in front of the wreath. Many of them were politicians or invited surviving family members. They walked slowly forward, placed their rose, stood for a moment's pause, and then turned to nod at the premier as the next person approached the memorial. After Premier François Legault gave brief remarks around 1 p.m., came a moment of silence. A bell begins to chime. March 11th might not be the exact day that you remember things changing, but this week in 2020 did mark a shift in history. There's mixed feelings but no rule book as to how to look back on 1 year into the COVID-19 pandemic. Everyone's had a distinctly unique experience. Much of it was spent analyzing the effects of various government-imposed measures or lack of measures and adjusting to health official recommendations. For example, Quebec saw an understaffing of nurses in care environments like long-term homes because of unstandardized working conditions, sickness, and burnout. Experts say that these workplace conditions contributed to the crisis in Quebec. Families of loved ones in just one of these asked Quebec to send the army at one point. That's at Maimonides Geriatric Center in Côte Saint-Luc, because they saw an outbreak there of more than 50 sick residents. Months later, Maimonides received Montreal's very first shipment of vaccines from the United States. Family members later demanded that Quebec administer both of two vaccine shots within Health Canada's recommendation timeframe. Premier François Legault said in response that Quebec is aiming to vaccinate more people with one shot than less people with both doses. Joyce Shanks is a member of the Maimonides Family Advocacy Committee, who were key characters in this timeline. The following interview has been edited for clarity and context.
There's nothing formal about us. We really are just concerned family members, and some of them are actual residents themselves who are part of the committee. And we're really just trying to give a voice to those who may not necessarily have a voice or are not being heard.
How many people are part of the committee?
There are hundreds of residents and hundreds of loved ones and caregivers and residents who are part of the Facebook group. And then from the Facebook group, a core group of loved ones or family members created a WhatsApp chat on the side. And that became more of a working group. And there's about 35 to 40 people in that working group. And then of that group, there's actually an even smaller core doing the letter writing and the communications and the research and stuff like that.
How about you? Do you have a loved one in Maimonides?
I do. My dad, who is 81, his name is Harvey Stoliar, and he has been at Maimonides for more than 5 years. When the pandemic hit, and what was first formed was a Facebook group where people spend a lot of time voicing their concerns and challenges and really just talking about what was going wrong. As much as I think that is incredibly valuable information, I'm much more of a doer than a talker. I kind of stayed back from being active on the Facebook group, but then in June, partway through the first wave, I was talking to my dad, and it was Father's Day, and he told me how hot he was in his room. It was actually a heat wave in Montreal, and I knew that the government had sent air conditioning units to the facilities so that people can be kept safe and cool. But I said, Daddy, isn't your air conditioner installed? And he said, I don't have an air conditioner. And that was when I realized that it was time to kind of roll up my sleeves and figure out and be part of the solution as opposed to just part of a conversation. And so it was Father's Day in June that I joined the WhatsApp group and became actively involved in collecting information of what was going on and what was wrong and being part of the solution or trying to be a part of the solution.
If you could walk through what the story of Maimonides in the pandemic was from your perspective, where would you start?
Yeah, so for sure, Maimonides is actually the second largest public center in the province of Quebec. So at the time of the outset of the pandemic, there were 387 residents in the facility. And they're not all senior citizens. And it's important to note that not everyone in the building is someone who is kind of old and stuff. It's a public facility for people who are unable to take care of themselves or live actively in their own homes. And during the first wave, which really kind of started March, April, May, like March, one of the first things that happened in the long-term care facilities is that caregivers were no longer allowed to go in. And I actually don't have a timeline in front of me of like the dates of things that closed down. The situation with my dad is a little bit unique in that he's pretty independent and didn't require me or anybody to be with him on a daily basis. And if you recall, long-term care facilities around the globe were suffering horrifically from the first wave of the pandemic. Not only were the residents getting sick and dying fairly quickly and fairly intensely, but at the same time, as people were being locked out, the residents themselves were not getting necessarily the care that they needed, whether it was nourishment or attention or hydration, because people were no longer allowed to go in and support them. They were not getting emotional support. Some were not getting nutritional support. If you recall what happened back at the Dorval Heron, neglect was part of the reason that so many died. Maimonides has suffered more than 60 deaths in both waves. I think the number is actually at 62. And then there were people who passed away between the first and the second wave, not because of COVID, but as a result of their personal deterioration or degradation that began during COVID. You know, as we talk about the memorial that took place yesterday, it's not just important to remember those who succumbed to COVID itself, but those who suffered as a result of COVID and their families and their loved ones, because it wasn't just those who lost their lives who suffered. Obviously, their families suffered tremendously. They couldn't be with those that they loved in their ending days. It reverberates through the whole community.
There was a press conference that was held in the fall. What was the ask during that time, and was it answered?
So in November, we held a press conference to insist that the government take action. We were in the middle of our second wave. And if you recall back to the promises made by our government during the first wave, and this is the tragedy, in my opinion, around the country, our prime minister, all the first ministers and premiers of the provinces made promises and said, we know what's wrong. We know what we did wrong. We know the mistakes that we made. We're going to do better. We know better. We're going to do better. This won't happen again. But it happened again. We had a second wave and we had more deaths. And even though one of the requests or needs for desperately was to bring in more staff, sufficient staff was not brought in and sufficient changes were not made and more people died. We had requested as an advocacy group, we had asked for N95 masks to keep the staff safe and to keep the staff from transmitting the virus. We firmly believe that the staff, even though the work they do is essential and great, we believe the staff were a huge contributing factor to the spread of the virus. And we were also asking for things like insisting that mandatory testing be done on staff. And that never happened. So the question is, if we were being told as a population to stop spreading the virus, we asked the question, but if you don't know who has the virus, how can you stop it from spreading? And we don't feel that all of our requests and all of our logical sharing of information, it fell on deaf ears because it happened again. And that's what's really, that's a big part of the tragedy because, I mean, where were the lessons learned? Where was the application of the knowledge that was gained in the first wave? We don't feel that it was carried through and we don't feel that the necessary changes took place. The truth is, the province of Quebec suffered the most amount of deaths than any other province in this country. And I don't think that's something to be forgotten. We lost the most amount of lives and we had the most amount of cases. Many of us believe it's because of poor decisions and late action taken by our government.
Maimonides was the first place to get the vaccine in Montreal. Is your dad vaccinated now?
My dad has now had his second dose of the vaccine. And I believe, or we believe, that because we were so vocal and because we were so determined to be the voice of our loved ones, it may have contributed to the fact that we were the first in the province to get the vaccine. And of course, our case numbers. We had unbelievably high case numbers. We lost over 60 lives in this pandemic so far. We were hugely, hugely disappointed and dismayed when the second dose of the vaccine was not given per our consent and per the pharmaceuticals recommended dosing. We were angry. We tried to stop the government or get the government to reverse their decisions because we had asked them all along to follow the science and they chose to go rogue and do what they wanted to do. And we felt that they were playing Russian roulette with our loved ones.
I just want to ask you how you're feeling this week.
Tired. We're so tired. It shouldn't have been a battle, but it's been a battle. So it's exhausting. We're battle weary. And of course, our loved ones are probably tired as well. But there is a little bit of relief that they have their second doses. We are also hopeful that they are protected. We don't know. The science doesn't exist. We don't know if the first dose was powerful enough to allow the second dose to fully protect them. We don't know. There was no immunity testing done, but we're hopeful that they are protected. And time will tell. But I think that's true for everybody. Time will tell. We tried really hard to get what we needed for our loved ones. And we're really sad that our efforts were too late for some. That's a hard thing to swallow because whatever we did may have benefited some. There are certainly some that we weren't able to support and help. And we just pray that their families can find peace.
Understaffing and workplace conditions for caregivers is also a question about the experiences of essential workers in the pandemic and their supports. Many who say they weren't given the support to do their jobs in a safe way. Alex Pelchat is a fifth grade teacher in Quebec's Francophone system. He's also part of the Progressive Education Workers Collective. They and their partners like the Immigrant Workers Center, the Quebec Nurses Association, various workers' unions, and migrant justice groups are meeting this weekend to celebrate the work and mark what this last year has meant for an essential worker in Quebec. Speaking from a schoolroom in between his classes, Pelchat says workers' unions and job protections have taken on a whole different meaning in the pandemic.
So for about 2 years, a lot of school workers from about 20 different unions joined forces as the Progressive Education Workers Collective. And we've been really active about a variety of issues, but COVID has been one of the main issues. And we had organized a protest in August because the early plan for a return to school included essentially a back to normal return to school. And so for us now, it was like a logical progression to talk about the fact that we've been essential workers for years, as have workers of all fields, including especially health, the private sector, the parastatal sector, and community and social services.
For you personally, have you had the same position throughout this whole pandemic?
Yes, I've been teaching for 12 years now, and while we did manage to work to teach from home from April to June, a lot of our coworkers who teach in schools for special needs students have had to go back to teach in Montreal as early as May or June. And they also have not been, they haven't had the chance to work from home even when we closed in early January, for example. So there's, in education itself, there's various stories where people in remote regions have been working almost throughout. But in Montreal, even people who work in special needs school are at work for almost a year now. A lot has changed. And I don't think that, even though it's difficult for anybody from kindergarten to the university level to adapt to this new world, the main issues that the collective and I have been trying to promote to talk about are the socio-political issues related to the lack of access to technology for students who are working class or come from poor communities, or even really middle class students who have a lot of siblings. You know, the Quebec school system really started with the idea that every family should buy a MacBook for every kid that they have. So that was already like one of the biggest challenges we had, was just the access to technology. So it's a really frustrating thing that's been going for a year now, where we're all willing to adapt our teaching to the pandemic, but every single time out, teachers are calling out the government and even their own teaching union sometimes to say like, hey, I can't be teaching with a class of 15 people because 8 of my poorest students cannot attend class. And a year into it, that's still not solved. So that's a really big challenge that we've had, is just the socioeconomic injustices that are pushed forward by this pandemic.
How have you seen or compared your experiences in the last year within the education sector with that of the other workplaces that are partnering in this demonstration?
Well, one crazy thing is that I feel like at times education workers were told to stop complaining about the various faults of the return to school plan based on the fact that healthcare workers and social services workers were suffering more. And certainly it's just a way to pit workers against one another. We have huge solidarity for healthcare and social services workers who have had over 30,000 cases of COVID. We've had 5,000. It's just really the right way to do this is to build solidarities. Our collective also supported social workers when they had a protest back in June or July, back when their vacations were being cut down and they had a whole bunch of special legislation to limit their rights as workers. So it's just more solidarity between people who have been deemed essential, air quotes, because the essential rhetoric is really kind of used to trample collective bargaining agreement or even like legislation about workers' rights. So there was a lot of enthusiasm about doing this event, partially because to different degrees, we've all been felt very pushed aside and pushed around and not cared for by the Quebec government, Legault's government.
You make a mention of Legault's government. I wanted to ask you, did you see the commemorative event that happened yesterday? And what would you add to that conversation as people look back on that in history?
It's such mixed feelings for me as a fifth grade teacher. We actually observed the minute of silence because a few of my students do know people who passed away from COVID. Some of my students contracted COVID and had a really horrible time being sick at home and missing 2 or 3 weeks worth of school. So it felt on a very emotional level. It felt like the right thing to do. But then there's all this frustration about the lack of care that we've taken for the health workers and the social service workers that have literally died from COVID, just the lack of care we've shown every essential worker, right? Like the CSN, which represents a lot of health workers, lobbied for months and months on end to get N95 to help workers. And that's not something that Legault will address in public, but that should be one of the things people remember is management of the crisis by the fact that it was always about cutting costs as much as possible, despite people's health being at risk. Same for us with the incredibly high number of schools that have bad air quality, no opening windows, non-working ventilation system. So the ceremony is great on this emotional level, and then it's horrible from the perspective of how much negligence has been done in the last year against essential workers.
Were you provided any PPE from the government?
The original plan in April and May of last year was not to provide even masks for us, which is astounding. And then they were not going to provide visors. I have my criticism regarding the way unions have handled some things, but regardless, I do want to highlight the fact that unions have had at every step of the game needed to ask for this PPE, which is astounding. And to this day, the problem of air quality and windows, opening windows, air purifiers is just left out of the debate. And there was a transfer of hundreds of millions of dollars from the Trudeau government that the Quebec government didn't use because it was federal money. So again, it's like, not only are we neglected as essential workers, but on top of that, there's this federalist separatist conflict that seems straight out of 1980 that prevented hundreds of millions of dollars of being invested in the public sector. It's really, really disheartening.
I have one more personal question. How are you marking this 1 year anniversary? You mentioned some mixed feelings that you had during that moment of silence. How do you feel this week?
It feels, being involved in a lot of organizing and mobilizing, it feels as though it's hard not to feel let down by the system in general, and especially the Legault government and the Ministry of Work. It just the 1 year for me, as somebody who didn't have to grieve, which I should mention, but looking back on a year of this pandemic, I feel a lot of anger at the people who have lost family members due to the lax measures that were put in place at work, due also even to certain spaces being open when they shouldn't have been. I guess on a very personal note, I feel upset that negligence is being ignored, if not applauded by certain people. So that's how I've been thinking a lot about it this week.
For this upcoming weekend, can you tell me the details of it?
So we are doing a rally that's going to celebrate 1 year of essential work and try to really highlight the fact that the whole society, Quebec society, has been going along with this pandemic, in great part due to essential workers, and that we simply deserve better as essential workers. It was really important for the Progressive Education Workers Collective to bring in people from the healthcare system, the social services workers, community workers, the parastatal workers, which means SAQ, SQDC, et cetera, et cetera, even public transit, and also to talk about immigration rights and workers, because that's been a huge issue that a lot of organizations, including the Immigration Workers Center, have highlighted the idea that we really benefited from workers who are migrants and need their statuses regularized. So that was really important for us to have this union of all these people who have put so much effort, their health, their well-being at stake, so that society can run as normally as possible. And so we have about a list of a dozen organizations that are joining. It's happening March 14th at 1 p.m. at Jarry Park next to Metro Castelnau. So that's the Gary Carter and Saint Laurent Boulevard intersection. And we'll hear the people who are going to have time to talk are really workers who have been working for the last year in these conditions. And they're going to talk about what is it they would have wanted, what is it they need, and what do they expect from the Legault government for going forward after giving a year of incredible, intense work efforts. The Progressive Education Workers Collective that I'm a part of is really, really invested in bringing up the conversation of workplace safety. To us, it's incredible that there's such a lack of discussion on this matter. Schools have had horrible air quality for decades at this point. The number of people that have to go on sick leave because of burnout or because of physical injuries in fields like healthcare and education is astounding. So there's this feeling that now is the time more than ever to talk about the fact that workers should not be getting sick from work, regardless of the field that they're in, that workplace safety and real workplace safety measures could prevent so many problems, injuries, ills that we have right now as illnesses that we have now as workers. So if the rally this Sunday can serve anything, that would be a great thing. Just realize that we need to stop sacrificing our health for work, essentially.
Members who are part of this collective and organizers across the city have echoed the resounding line that the pandemic exacerbated existing inequalities and social issues. This week marks a significant death count and also brings a moment of pause about what else was lost in this unprecedented year. CKUT wants to hear from you about what you're thinking at this time of memorial, in this time of memorial and reflection. How are you? How are you? How are you? What has this week or year been like for you? And what will you remember when you look back on this moment in history?
We're on the corner of Fairmount and Clark, putting up posters because we have a phone line for people to call if they want to talk about how they're doing in quarantine. It's a pink piece of paper. The number is 514-448-4041. And the extension is 7,000.
We want to hear about how you're doing. Call us and leave a message, and we might play them on the air. That number, again, is 514-448-4041, extension 7,000. Just call, leave a message, thank you in advance, and stay safe. I'm Sarah Jesmer, and you're listening to CKUT.
CKUT Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
CKUT.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. For the second segment of the hour, we're going to return to a February conversation. The Center for Gender Advocacy talked with Sarah Jesmer about changing the provincial civil code to be more inclusive of queer and trans residents. Quebec Superior Court ruled in January in favor of most, but not all, of the center's challenges. Quebec's government appealed that decision this week, and it will return to court. This conversation with Sarah Jesmer and Jada Joseph took place before the appeals announcement, but explains the effects of this case.
Jada Joseph is the peer support training and drop-in coordinator at the Center for Gender Advocacy. What were some of the discussions that the center heard before this lawsuit came around in 2014?
We originally had filed a lawsuit against the Attorney General in 2014. And the lawsuit that we brought forth sought to invalidate 11 articles of the Quebec Civil Code, specifically articles 59, 62, 71, 93, 111, 115, 116, 124, 126, 132, and 146 of the Quebec Civil Code. And what we were arguing is that these particular codes intersectionally, as they, of course, impact individuals at multiple levels and at different intersections, it violates the rights, integrity, safety, freedom, dignity, as well as the privacy granted by the Quebec Charter of Rights, as well as the Canadian Charter of Freedoms and Rights of trans, non-binary, and intersex people living in Quebec. Before the lawsuit actually came about, it was launched by Gabrielle Bouchard, who was our trans rights educator and advocate at that time. And she was, although also doing education work about trans awareness, she was also doing social work as well, in which she would assist individuals with name and sex designation change. And by virtue of doing this, she, and through her own lived experiences, of course, has witnessed the different barriers that trans folks navigated while trying to acquire name and or sex designation changes. And not only just the process of acquiring such, but also to how having access to these different changes intertwines with the lived experiences and the different ways people navigate their lives. So through housing, in education settings, in workspaces, this one macro level barrier definitely has interconnected impacts on people's lived experiences. So by virtue of that, she acquired information to then present to our co-plaintiffs, as well as the two lawyers who also assisted us in this court case. And that's pretty much what led to this lawsuit.
Can you explain specific things that were being challenged?
So we had different aspects of the code that we wanted to change. For starters, we wanted for trans migrants to be able to change their name and sex designation, as currently only Canadian citizens who have been living in Quebec for over a year have the possibility of changing their name and sex designations in Quebec. So that was one. The other aspect that we wanted to change was for, with regards to sex designation options, only male or female is currently the only options available. And we also wanted to expand that so that it isn't only male or female, so that we can, respect and honor the fact that non-binary people are living and have been living for years. And thirdly, we also wanted to allow trans parents the possibility of changing their parental role from mother, father, or as well as parent. This was something that was really important, as this not only reflects and honors the realities of trans families and really acknowledges what these families look like by allowing for this. We also wanted to, by virtue of doing this, it allows for and guarantees privacy as well. And another aspect of the code that we wanted to remove was for trans youth to not have to receive medical evaluations by different mental health practitioners in order to obtain a name and or sex designation change, as well as removing parental veto, which allows parents to object their child's application for a name and or sex designation. Another part of the civil code that we wanted to remove as well is the requirement for sex designation at birth. That's a common thing that is practiced in North American societies and has been pushed by the West. And this was something we especially wanted to do while thinking about intersex children who forcefully undergo surgeries in order to uphold like Western science needs of this two-sex system. So yeah, those are some of the articles that we wanted to strike down.
How does Quebec's civil code compare to the code of other provinces?
I don't have extensive knowledge, so I'm going to briefly talk about like what I just simply know, like one point. This is not an area that I'm expert in, but a really key piece is related to trans migrants. Quebec is one of the only provinces in Canada in which Canadian citizenship is required. If we look at other provinces such as Ontario, Canadian citizenship is not required. People are often required to have been living in the province for a period of 3 months to a year in which they're able to change their name and sex designation. So clearly, we see here that Quebec has a definite xenophobic and transphobic issue here.
Why is this not a federal issue? And how do those jurisdictions overlap?
Yeah, so I can talk about this in the context of, say, for trans migrants. So for people who have permanent residency on their PR cards and PR documents, it is possible to change your name and sex designation. However, you have to receive the approval through the province. So it's often provincially, it's the province on a provincial level in which people can access changing one's name and sex designation. And once that is completed, you can then do so on your PR document, which is under federal level. It's a federal provision, right? So it's the federal government that is responsible for that. So that's one example. And in the context of, for instance, birth certificates, it is under provincial level. And this is the case for so many different things, like financially, like finances, social and whatnot. Often, you know, the federal government provides like a basic guideline. So for instance, such as the Canadian Charter of Rights, right? That is a basic guideline that all provinces try to live up to, and thus they then develop their own accordingly that they apply within their own province. However, provincial provinces often are awarded the responsibility of delegation. So pretty much the materialized aspects of people's lives, such as birth certificates and things of that matter, is under provincial jurisdiction.
What were the conversations that were happening at the center as you all waited for this decision from 2014 to now in 2021?
I really can't say again, unfortunately, because I'm not the person who has spearheaded the court case, which is Dalia Torkey. And the person who launched the court case was Gabrielle Bouchard. So these are like the two folks, and especially during the times in which we went into the trial. It's really Dalia Torkey. She was the one who was putting in the work. She was one who was speaking with interveners, in which the interveners of our case includes EGAL Canada, LGBTQ Family Coalition, and Gender Creative Kids. She was the one who was working with our interveners. She was the one who was speaking with our lawyers, Audrey and Francois. She was the one who was speaking with our co-plaintiffs, Samuel Singer, Sarah Blumel, Abby Heller, and Jenna Jacobs. That's all her. I really want to emphasize that. So my response is going to be thus really limited, because I really want to honor and respect the fact that, she was the one who was doing that work. So I really want to highlight that. So in terms of from the things that I've seen from my perspective and what I've witnessed as the peer support drop-in coordinator, is that there was a lot of delegation that we had to do in the sense of planning out week by week the trial hearings. So when we had our hearings, ensuring that there were peer support volunteers to provide active listening, to ensure that there was enough staff present, ensuring that the appropriate experts were present, following up with experts and witnesses, also rallying the community to attend the court hearings as well, which was definitely very challenging to hear the defense present very dehumanizing quote unquote evidence. I would say that's kind of what it looked like during pre the court case actually happening. It was a lot of Dahlia doing that work of connecting with the community and different interveners and organizations, as well as our co-plaintiffs and our witnesses as well. It's really her. I want to just emphasize that tremendously.
Could you explain a little bit about the decision that you got in January, and did anything surprise you?
We were really happy to have received the decision, we waited a long time. We first had the trial in 2019, and then we only received the decision in January 2021. So it was a long, anxious year and some change of anxiety and just waiting for a long time, because there were so many, people who are directly impacted by the results and, the judgment. It is a 58-page document, so we had to wait for our lawyers to, unpack that information, and we're still unpacking that information because it is so much. It's 58 pages. But from that, what we were able to gather, and what we also know for sure, is that the judge, Justice Gregory Moore, he rendered many things unconstitutional, such as the requirement that people could only be designated as either male or female, as well as the fact that trans parents are unable to change their parental role from mother, father, or parent on their children's birth certificates, as well as the requirement for trans youth to seek medical evaluations, to receive sex and or name changes, as well as the requirement of Canadian citizenship to change one's name and sex designation. Yeah, those are the first things that we saw that we won, which was really exciting. And the things that we were surprised about was we were actually surprised that we didn't was able to win the parental veto objection. We really wanted to remove the quote unquote right given to parents to deny their children's applications, because we had presented not only expert knowledge, but also the lived experiences of trans and non-binary individuals who have been directly impacted by set requirement, by set veto given to parents. So that was definitely devastating and also surprising, because we felt very confident in the information presented. And most importantly, we just thought it was shocking, given you know, the fact that they remove one gatekeeper, which are, you know, the medical evaluation from mental health practitioners, but yet, you know, another gatekeeper remains, which is parents. You know, not only is one living at home, potentially living at home with a transphobic parent, but then, you know, in order to, you know, potentially leave the house, you know, which requires getting a job and these different things, or even just trying to apply, you know, for assistance, that process in and of itself can be triggering if one is not able to, you know, put the name and sex designation that is theirs. So that thus then puts youth at risk for homelessness, which is again why we were really surprised and shocked by, you know, this very contradicting result. And we were also shockingly very shocked by the fact that the requirement for sex designation is still required. Given the extensive evidence presented about the harmful and forceful interventions done on intersex children at early ages. Upholding that requirement really erased the experiences of intersex individuals across Quebec.
What are some of the concrete things that changed from the day this decision was published?
So the Quebec government has until December 31st, 2021 to implement these changes to the Quebec Civil Code. The center will be observing and watching the Quebec Civil Code to verify that these changes will be made, and we'll be updating the community through our website and Facebook as we observe the changes. So in terms of has anything been like the material changes, it's still new because, you know, they have until technically December 31st, 2021 to implement that. But what it would look like when they occur is that people can change their sex designation to male, female, or X. And parents would also be able to change their parental role on their children's birth certificates. Trans migrants will also be able to change their name and sex designation. And all of these various things will have both social, financial, legal, as well as interpersonal implications to individuals living across Quebec.
What are some of the emotions that you're feeling, that the center is feeling, that you're seeing? Broadly speaking, this is a huge historic landmark to change parts of the provincial civil code.
For me, it was really definitely emotional. It was a multitude of emotions, happiness, relief, but also, grief as well, because of the two points that we lost. As I mentioned, you know, it was such a contradictory blow that it was, it was a mixture of emotions. I couldn't say that I felt any, you know, solely happy or solely upset. It was definitely a mixture of things because of the nature of the judgment. But I was also thinking about individuals who would directly be impacted by this. You know, I was thinking about all the trans, non-binary, and intersex migrants that frequently come to the center, that frequently message us about, you know, pathways into changing their name and sex designation. I was also thinking about trans parents being able to have their family recognized on a legal but also interpersonal level. You know, like, these things can pop up in the very smallest ways through, you know, accessing daycare and accessing care, going to the hospital for your child. There's so many different implications in which, you know, one's privacy and safety, and also just sense of being recognized would be impacted. So yeah, I also started thinking about trans youth who, you know, now won't have to receive medical evaluation which is also financially a burden for many. But then also thinking about the fact that they're, you know, the parental veto is still upheld, you know, and also just thinking about how this unstable position they're now left in, where it's like, okay, medical evaluations are no longer available, but, you know, my parent can still object, you know? So I was also thinking about that as well. And I was also thinking about intersex folks and just how the, you know, upholding sex designation just completely erases, you know, their experiences, the ongoing historical structurally enforced, you know, surgeries that are implemented on intersex folks. So yeah, those were all of the things that I was thinking about when we received the decision.
Is there anything else that, is there anyone else that was part of this work that you wanted to mention?
Our co-plaintiffs are Samuel Singer, Sarah Blumel, Ivy Heller, and Jenna Jacobs. Our interveners are EGAL Canada, LGBT Family Coalition, and Gender Creative Kids. Also would like to thank our witnesses, our testifiers, all those folks who attended our trials, our peer support volunteers who were able to offer support, all the experts who were able to offer their knowledge, all individuals who are directly impacted, you know, our trans, our non-binary, our intersex folks living in Quebec currently, also through their very existence, supporting us in this court case, the legacy of the activism of trans women of color, the ongoing legacy and activism of trans women of color that spans and dates back since time. And also thinking about the trans organizations that are for and by trans folks such as Aztec.
Welcome back to Off the Hour. You were just listening to a February conversation between Sarah Jesmer and Jada Joseph from the Center for Gender Advocacy. The decision Joseph talked about will be appealed, or brought back to court, according to a condemnation by the center this week.
Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing...
And as always, we'll leave you with news you can use. This week will be full of demonstrations across Montreal. On Saturday, the anti-gentrification group Mile and Ensemble is organizing a read-in to support the S.W. Welch bookstore. A read-in means participants are encouraged to buy a book, sit and read in line. That's tomorrow at 2 p.m. at the S.W. Welch bookstore on Saint-Viateur-Ouest. And on Monday, the Collective Against Police Brutality is organizing a protest to abolish the police. That's at Park Metro Station at 5 p.m. on Monday, March 15th. And next Friday, groups like Climate Justice Montreal and Solidarity Across Borders are gathering at the Georges-Étienne Cartier Monument. They want to defund the police, achieve carbon neutrality by 2030, demand the regularization of migrants, and uphold Indigenous sovereignty. That's next Friday at 5:30 p.m. at the Monument on Park. And today is the first day of Cuperk McGill's Culture Shock Festival, a free annual event that promotes anti-racism, migrant justice, and Indigenous solidarity. You can find this year's lineup of virtual panels and workshops at qpirgmcgill.org. And the Masamadi Arts Festival ends today. This year's event is free and virtual, showcasing the work of LGBTQ Afro creators. If you want to learn more, you can check out masamadi.ca. And CKUT is approaching a one-year anniversary of operating remotely. To mark the moment, we're holding a funding drive on March 18th. We're a community station, and all public support makes a difference. Off the Hour is aiming to raise $100 for the station, and we can only do that with your support. Mark your calendars for March 18th. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The team includes Brian Isaac, Grace Cobalt, Alice Wu, Kate Addison, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please reach out to us at CKUT's Community News Department by sending an email to newsintern@ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Facebook by searching CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe, coming up next.
De la COVID-19 a affecté les vies de chacun de différentes manières. Elle a également attiré notre attention sur l'intensification du racisme systémique et de la xénophobie sélective envers nos amis racisés dans notre société canadienne.
Il est compréhensible que chacun d'entre nous se sente anxieux face à cette maladie dangereuse. Cependant, ce sentiment d'angoisse ne nous donne pas le droit de commettre des crimes de haine et de discriminer nos amis asiatiques, noirs, autochtones et autres personnes racisées. Il n'est pas acceptable d'associer la maladie COVID-19 aux Asiatiques, en particulier à ceux d'origine chinoise. Il n'est pas acceptable de commettre des abus physiques et psychologiques à l'égard des personnes racisées. Il n'est pas acceptable de vandaliser des entreprises appartenant à des Asiatiques et à d'autres marginaux. Nous devons arrêter de normaliser et cesser d'accepter les comportements racistes et les discours de haine à l'endroit de toute communauté racisée. Au contraire, pendant cette crise d'épidémie mondiale, nous devons ensemble nous éduquer et comprendre les concepts de race, de racisme systémique et de la justice raciale au Canada et ailleurs. Souvenons-nous, malgré qui et où nous sommes tous humains. Nous devons apprendre à nous tenir ensemble en tant que citoyens du monde pour une communauté plus saine, plus sûre et plus heureuse.
Saturday, March 20th, as CKUT DJ Andy Williams and Never Apart present an afternoon with the goddess of underground hip-hop, Medusa, live and direct from Los Angeles. Medusa is an MC, singer, poet, writer,